afternoon, and welcome to From Where We Are, stories of news and culture through the lens of USC and Southern California. I'm Jack Waterman, coming to you live from Studio B in USC's Annenberg Media Center.
And I'm Stefan De La Guardia. It's November 11th. Happy Veterans Day. On today's show, does this university do enough to celebrate Veterans Day? The Weekender gets canceled. And did you know child marriage can be legal in California? All that and more from Where We Are.
On a national holiday aimed to celebrate brave men and women who have served in our nation's military, USC takes the time to honor its very own Trojan veterans. The First Gen Plus Success Center, in collaboration with the Veterans Resource Center, hosted a Veterans Day viewing party earlier today. Chelsea Hilton has more on USC's Veterans Day celebration.
Veterans Day falls every year on November 11th, the day after the Marine Corps birthday. Most public schools around the country observe the day as a national holiday, and businesses offer veterans select discounts. USC's celebration included a gathering at the centers where a virtual event hosted by USC's president Carol Folt was played. The space was decorated with red balloons, American flags, and flags representing every branch of the military. Attendees were also treated to lunch. The current president of USC's Veterans Association is Marine veteran Johnny Walker. Walker served for 13 years, including tours in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
I joined the Marine Corps. I joined because of 9/11. I was in high school and I was in Texas, and it was in my first class of the day. My teacher left for a second and then came back running in frantically and turned on the TV. And then I saw that the first tower was already struck, and then I watched the second plane hit the second tower. And that's when I decided to join the Marine Corps.
Due to COVID, Walker said the day's celebrations are limited, but USC has managed to find safe ways of bringing folks together to celebrate. The virtual event featured multiple interviews from USC alumni who are veterans. Many professors at the university who have served before spoke about what being a Trojan veteran means to them. Walker, who is 34, is currently pursuing his bachelor's in business administration at the Marshall School of Business.
Veterans do provide a different view of the normal traditional student. And because most of us aren't traditional students, most of us are usually above the age of 25. We have a little bit of a life experience that's different from most, and a lot of people can benefit from us.
In attendance at the in-person event was Navy veteran Jordan Sugarman. Sugarman, who served for 4 years, was excited to be in attendance.
Veterans Day means a lot to me. It just reminds me of all the sacrifices that past generations and current generations are making.
Sugarman, who is 31 years old, is studying finance at Marshall. He has hopes of pursuing a career in investment banking and later returning to school to obtain his MBA. Sugarman is attending USC for a specific reason.
When I was applying to colleges, to universities, that was one of the most important things to me was where were they ranked in their veterans program. And USC is known for honoring veterans all the way back to World War I.
Many schools across the country give their students and staff the day off, like USC's rival, UCLA. They give their campus communities the day off in observance for the holiday. USC does not.
I don't understand USC's understanding for why it's not why we're not let off of it, because I just don't understand. So maybe if we just had that conversation with the faculty and staff about, or whoever made the decision for the schedule, just have a conversation why are we not allowed a day off?
One thing that Sugarman and Walker hope for in the future is more attention to veterans and the issues they face.
I just think just more events like this, just more anything that brings the community of veterans together and celebrates us and kind of highlights our stories and what we're doing.
For myself and everyone at Annenberg Media, we say thank you to all of our veterans. I'm Chelsea Hilton.
On Tuesday, Yahoo News senior political correspondent and USC Annenberg expert-in-residence John Ward spoke with USC students about his upbringing, career path, and 2 decades of experience in political journalism and long-form storytelling. After the event, Ward sat down with Annenberg Media and opened up about his background, how he got into journalism, and what he believes are the industry's challenges going forward. Mateo Gutierrez reports.
USC Annenberg hosted an 80-minute open conversation with Ward. Ward was mostly uninterested in politics growing up and wasn't very political in college either. He also did not study journalism in college. Ward was raised in an evangelical Christian household, which he believes has a significant impact on his worldview and outlook on politics from a young age.
One of the big themes of conservative evangelical Christianity during the time that I was growing up was the way that we thought of ourselves as not political really at all, and we thought of politics as something that was a little bit dirty. We didn't want to really be too involved in it.
Ward knew he wanted to become a writer, which led him to journalism after teaching literature for 2 years after college. Political journalism had the most opportunity for him. But the landscape of journalism, and political journalism in particular, has shifted rapidly in recent years, presenting challenges for a future generation of journalists.
There's no doubt that the biggest change in journalism over the last 20 years that I've been in the business has been the loss of trust that millions of people in this country have in the media. And so I think that's the big challenge for any journalist and for the media writ large, is to think creatively about ways to earn back that trust.
That loss of trust is linked to a perceived lack of objectivity, not just in journalism, but in all spaces.
No one is fully objective. I think when people talk about objectivity, what they mean is, are you trying to tell the story truthfully? Are you trying to further an agenda, or are you kind of following the facts where they lead? I think that's really what we mean when we talk about objectivity.
Ward says everyone's worldview is impacted by their background. Being able to unpack and apply his own outlook to his interactions is a lengthy process. However, he encourages young journalists and people in general to be aware of and learn from each other's differences.
The challenge for us as American citizens is to reach across difference and disagreement and reconcile with people who might see us as different, who might be threatened by us, who might disagree with us. We need to really work on unifying this country however we can.
Ward's perspective as a political journalist could be a way to bring people together in years to come. But the 2022 midterm election and 2024 presidential election will continue to test America's unity. For Annenberg Media, I'm Mateo Gutierrez.
Were you looking forward to the return of the Weekender at Berkeley? Well, you'll unfortunately have to wait a little bit longer. Here's Adam Jasper with the story.
UC Berkeley postponed its Saturday game against USC after a COVID-19 outbreak that ravaged the Cal football team. Although 99% of the team is fully vaccinated, more than 24 players tested positive for COVID before their last game. As of Tuesday, the number had increased to 44. Traveling upstate to attend the rivalry game has become an annual tradition for the Trojan community. Here's sophomore Carson Locke on the USC tradition, where all students travel north to support their team and take down the Bears.
And that base of tradition, like, it's something that USC students have, like, always done. I was really looking forward to just, like, getting out of LA and, like, seeing San Francisco and Berkeley in general and just kind of, like, what that campus is like.
Many students coming to campus for the first time had been looking forward to joining the tradition. As a transfer student, Emily Cox hasn't had the opportunity to experience a Berkeley versus USC game.
I was a transfer my sophomore year, and then it was canceled junior year, so I've never been. And so I have friends at Berkeley. It sounds like a fun experience.
USC senior Quincy Hurt is a part of the school's band, who loves seeing the cardinal and gold colors at away games. That will not happen this time.
It's nice to feel like the family travels with us and cares enough to be there, so I think it's always fun to see that kind of takeover of cities and know that our fan base is passionate about the team and willing to travel for it.
But despite the game delay, the Trojans will be ready to unite and take on the Bears next month. For Annenberg Media, I'm Adam Jasper.
It is still legal for children in California to get married. Yes, that's right. And it only requires the consent of just one parent through a court order. Many of these marriages are between young girls to men significantly older than them, making way for gender-based violence in the marriage. Tanishtha Sinha spoke with survivors of child marriage about the practice.
Don Tyre got married in California at 13 to her abuser. He was 32. When she was 11, her parents left her in the hands of the man when they started their business in Texas. He brainwashed her into thinking that what they shared was love.
At that time, at 13 years old, I could see clearly that society valued the life of a man over, you know, a woman, over a girl. Like, his future and his life was more important than mine.
Dawn is still grappling with her childhood trauma.
In the times where the abuse is happening, there's kind of this disconnect where it's almost like an out of body where, you know, I'm disassociating, so I don't have to be fully present during the abuse.
Global Hope 365 is an organization which is working actively towards eliminating child marriage. The advocate for a no child marriage under 18, no exception resolution, which has been passed in several cities in California. They are also working for changes in legislation at the state level. Rima Nashashibi, founder of the organization, says that this topic shocks even lawmakers.
A good number of them are not aware of the fact that it's legal because we meet with elected officials and some of them don't know that child marriage is still legal. So you have to raise awareness among the general public and elected officials.
Nashashibi has also observed that some officials think that the only recourse for pregnant girls is marriage. She talked about the effect child marriage has on a person's mind.
A survivor of child marriage tells us that even till today she has nightmares. She's still going to therapy even till today. She was married at 16 and she's in her mid-50s.
As well as the effect it has on the body.
There's a higher percent of sexually transmitted diseases, infant and maternal mortality, because the girl's body is not fully developed yet. So there's a higher rate of either maternal mortality or infant mortality or poor health in general because she had to get pregnant at such an early age. And then because you don't get the education, you don't get the vocational training, so you end up, most end up living in a poverty situation because of the lack of education and the lack of vocational training. And it's going to take them longer to rebuild their lives.
Child marriage is not happening to a few people. More than 300,000 child marriages took place in the United States from 2000 to 2018. As a child, Sarah Tasneem wanted to join the U.S. Air Force Academy. But when she turned 15, her father forced her to marry a 28-year-old stranger.
I was 15 years old when I was forced to marry. My father introduced me to a man in the morning, and I was married to him that same evening.
She says he raped her, and she got pregnant right away.
At 16 and pregnant, there was no way for me to get out of this marriage. I was basically, I mean, when I look back at it, I was a kidnapped victim. A lot of that time period is kind of numb for me. I don't really remember feeling a lot because I think that was part of the trauma.
She theorized why the laws are not changing yet in California.
We're allowing children to get married. And in the state of California, at any age, with parental consent and judicial review. So it's extremely troubling to think that people would continue to justify this today. It is pedophilia. If you look at the statistics today, the majority of children who are getting married are girls, and they're marrying adult men. And many of those marriages skirt around statutory rape laws and age of consent laws. And so that is really clear in my mind that This is sex that these laws are extremely sexist and biased against women.
The work of survivor advocates and activists have seen several milestones till date. They have been able to set the minimum age for marriage to 18 in 6 states. However, child marriage is still legal in 44 states in the United States. While the journey towards a total abolition of the practice is long, these victories inspire them to keep going. For Annenberg Media, I'm Tanishtha Sinha.
I'm Stefan Delaguardia. We're glad you're with us for From Where We Are.
And I'm Jack Waterman. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Coming up, how TikTok saved a 16-year-old's life and the living history of Pomona. Stay with us. Stefan, I don't know if you've been around the Annenberg hallways recently, but have you seen the photographs and archival documents outside?
I actually have. I just saw them for the first time today. It's for Veterans Day, right?
Yeah, it is. Apparently, Annenberg is housing an exhibition called Waging Peace in Vietnam in honor of Veterans Day.
Oh, that's actually pretty neat. Do you know how long it's going to be here for?
You know, it started today, and I believe it's up till December 3rd.
It's neat.
So super exciting. And from Stefan and I and everyone here at Annenberg Radio, we just really want to extend our deepest thanks to all the veterans. Thank you guys so much for your service.
Jack, that was really kind of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was. You know, speaking of kindness, Saturday is World Kindness Day. Laja Mistry talked to students on campus about random acts of kindness they've experienced. You good Samaritans.
Oh, yeah.
Day after day, it feels as if we've been fed with a lot of negative news. So for a change, I decided to focus on the bright side and ask people about an act of kindness, one either they experienced or performed for someone else. After all, we all need our daily dose of good feels. For communication student Paul Yee, kindness lies in the everyday simple act.
I think it's just simple as just opening the doors, to be honest, because we're all so busy with our lives and we seem to just head to point A and point B that we kind of fail to recognize the power in humanity. And just simply as opening a door for one another, I think is the smallest step, an actionable step towards, I would say, kindness.
According to Paul, kindness can be contagious.
The other person will likely, it will cause a domino effect and they will do the same action or thing to another person.
Freshman Tally Duckworth says that kindness means making someone feel better after a rough day.
I'm actually planning to do this later today, but my roommate told me that her dog passed away last night, and so I was just going to plan to go to Target, make her a little care package, say like, hey, I'm here for you, anything you need, and I think she's going to go home this weekend, so just giving her some time to hang out with her family this weekend too, I think will be good.
Target employee Andre recalls his experience of unexpected kindness at a restaurant.
Well, when I went to eat one time at a restaurant with my friends, someone actually, you know, grabbed a check for us and they paid our meal. So we weren't expecting that. It was just some random stranger that we didn't even know. And when we asked for the bill, it was already paid for by that stranger. So we never knew who it was. We just knew someone had paid for our meal.
USC music student Angelica Brooks practices kindness every now and then in her day-to-day life.
Paid for someone's meal behind me in the drive-thru. Had no idea how much it was. But, you know, hey, I'll just pay for their meal. And, in fact, the cashier was a little stunned. Like, are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. So, yeah.
Angelica has made it a practice to buy meals for strangers at least 3 or 4 times a year.
This sometimes when you're sitting in a drive-thru and you know, you're sitting there for so long, sometimes you can see through your rearview mirror, you know, if the person behind you like has a lot of kids or if they look very like disdained on their face, you're like, you know what, they look like they could use a free meal, so I'll just pay.
World Kindness Day is marked in many countries every November 13th. But you don't need a day to celebrate act of kindness. It can be any day or every day. For Annenberg Media, I'm Lajja Mistry.
Today, more than 1 billion people are on TikTok. Wow. And it's more than just dance and comedy videos being shared. For one 16-year-old girl, TikTok saved her life. Alina Botros has more.
Last Thursday, a 16-year-old girl who was reported missing was rescued from her kidnapper after flashing a hand gesture to passing cars while traveling through Kentucky. After seeing the gesture, a person in a nearby car called police. Shortly after, her captor was arrested. Scott Weinstein, a freshman student here at USC, was shocked when he heard about the story.
When I first heard about the story, I thought it was incredible that something as simple as a hand gesture on social media could save someone's life.
This hand gesture is intended to help people in dangerous situations who are unable to speak aloud. It was created by the Canadian Women's Foundation and has since gone viral on TikTok. Thursday's events bring into question TikTok's impact on society. Though TikTok has been criticized in the past, it might be bridging a gap in a whole new way. Kaylin Takamoto, a graduate student, sees TikTok as a way to participate in political conversations online.
A lot of the younger generation are being exposed to more political movements, sort of like the whole like Black Lives Matter over the summer. Like that was really awesome. And I think there are definitely some like younger folks who wouldn't have had as much knowledge given to them if it wasn't for like the resources being spread on TikTok.
Stacy Lieska, an adjunct journalism professor at USC, believes there are still parts of social media that can be good for the global community, but many focus on the negatives.
Ignoring social media at this point in history is a mistake. I think that while we have fun on social media, to see it as frivolous would be disingenuous to what social media can be. It's a place where, you know, the mass majority of Americans receive their news.
As the app grows, many hope that TikTok will continue to be influential in its ability to reach audiences and spread awareness. A young girl is home safe, thanks to what can now be considered a distress signal. For Annenberg Media, I'm Elena Botros.
The newly released film Dune is making waves, both good and bad. Some fans are upset that billboards and promo shots highlighting Zendaya don't reflect how much screen time she actually has in the film. With more on the story, here's Jesse Cooper.
The sci-fi film Dune, based on a book series, premiered earlier this month and is set in the future of a complex feudal society. Zendaya's character, Chani, is integral to the story. However, her character, though key to the plot, barely appears in the film. Even Zendaya shares that her character, Chani, has much more to come.
And I think we just kind of scratched the surface of these characters.
In promotional ads and billboards, Zendaya's face has been plastered next to Timothée Chalamet's, who plays the film's main character. Fans were eager to see the stars grace the screen together, but once the film was released, audiences were quick to share their disappointment. Cinema and media studies student Annabelle G read the novel and knew what to expect. She points out that there are many differences in the perspectives people have.
That people are super angry about how little she was on screen.
When you first search the film Dune on Google, the first question to pop up is Zendaya even in Dune? The answer, yes, but barely. Her voice both opens and closes the film, but still, Zendaya does not show up until about 2 hours and 20 minutes into the film. And when she finally does, she graces the screen for a mere 15 minutes. Jean Del Vecchio, professor of entertainment marketing at Marshall, says that while Zendaya's lack of screen time was noticeable, it didn't take away from her character's impact in the film.
The importance of Zendaya's role as Chani in Dune should not be measured by the amount of time she had on screen, but instead, you have to look at the amount of influence her character had on Paul Atreides, played by Timothée Chalamet.
Zendaya herself acknowledged her smaller presence in the film.
The film is we don't really know much about her. We kind of only get glimpses of her and views of her from Paul's visions.
The underwhelming use of the actor in the film stirred up outrage on social media, with Twitter users saying that they felt a bit misled with the film's marketing.
film studios essentially selling their actors to increase viewers and increase the amount of tickets that are bought.
However, this is not anything new, as fans have been Zendaya-fished by studios before. In Spider-Man Homecoming, Zendaya's character MJ was on screen yet again, not for very long. Annabelle, studying this subject, has a more nuanced perspective.
I think this market ploy is very common, especially in filmmaking, and I don't think people are unaware of it, and I think people actually appreciate it often. There are so many times when I will watch a movie solely because a certain actor is in it.
But good news for the future. Although Zendaya had a smaller role in Dune, fans can expect to see more of her in the sequel. In fact, Dune's director, Denis Villeneuve, had previously stated that he plans for Chani to be the main protagonist in Dune Part 2, and for the story to be told from her point of view. While the sequel is great news for Zendaya fans, the question of who is valued in the promotion process still remains.
Who is the filmmaker going to try and please more?
For Annenberg Media, I'm Jesse Cooper.
You may have heard it said that Los Angeles is a city without history. That LA's story began not long ago, the first time someone picked up a movie camera. The truth is, historic gems are scattered far and wide across LA County. You just have to be willing to look off the beaten path. Ryan Coleman reports on a piece of living history on the edge of LA County.
As you travel east out of Los Angeles, the urban gives way to the suburban, the homes get smaller and further apart, and all that chrome and glass are replaced by empty lots and rolling hills. This is the San Gabriel Valley, stretching from Pasadena in the west to the subject of today's story in the east, Pomona. You might never imagine that this sleepy, working-class suburb, 30 miles outside the city center, is home to some of the richest history in all of LA County.
Downtown Pomona has had a long and varied history.
That's Deborah Clifford, president of the Historical Society of Pomona Valley.
When the first when the town came into being in 1888, the downtown area was a mixture of people's homes and businesses, dusty streets, and uneven sidewalks. As the city developed, it became a really thriving downtown. And so out here in the Pomona Valley, Pomona was known as the Queen.
The same year Pomona was founded, a Methodist congregation traveled west from Riverside and built the Pomona Holy Church. This monument of Southern California history still presides over downtown Pomona. And though it's not on any registry of historic sites, it's revered by locals as a symbol of the city itself.
When they built it, it was a thriving downtown. We're still in that Pomona Queen of the Valley stage, so that people are coming from all over to go to church, to eat in fine restaurants, to stay in nice hotels. All of that was there when the church first began. But that church has lived beyond that, and so has sort of been a witness to the decline. And at this point, to the resurgence of the whole area.
When freeways and shopping malls came in after World War II, people moved east to Ontario, where there was more land, and west to LA, where there was more city. Pomona and the Holy Church went into a state of decline that lasted decades. But a growing group of artists, business owners, and civic advocates are trying to restore Pomona to its former magnificence. At the forefront is Andrew Huang, who bought the Holy Church in 2017 with Pastor Johnson Yang. Before they could reopen it for services, the church needed a major renovation.
So it's a very tough job. We spent almost more than 2 years. So Johnson at that time stay at the church, live in the church, full time, try to fix everything.
I was having a hard time wrapping my head around what it takes to fix up a 133-year-old church that had been sitting empty for years. And Huang noticed.
Is it possible? Do you want to take a look?
Yeah.
Maybe it's easier to explain everything.
Sure, yeah. Why don't we do that?
Take a look first.
Sure, yeah. Okay. Yeah, let's go take a look.
So we got to walking. The exterior was hit hardest by neglect. The thousands of shingles which cover the facade and go all the way up the 77-foot-tall bell tower needed to be completely redone.
So difficult to fix. We are too high. We hired a professional company, spent several months to fix. This is the most difficult part for the shingle, to restructure the shingle.
The Holy Church doesn't look too big from the outside, but inside, it's a sprawling 21,000 square foot maze. There are the usual sanctuaries and prayer rooms, but also dining rooms, an industrial-sized kitchen, and dozens of bedrooms for lodgers upstairs. It was definitely designed in the 19th century, so it's easy to get lost.
It really just keeps going.
Yeah.
Some things were so old, I couldn't even comprehend them. Like a set of stairs that leads down into a strange glass tank built into the wall of the nave.
People can go in down for the water.
Oh, like for baptism.
Baptism, yes.
Wow, do you guys do that here?
No, because we need a lot of water.
The renovations are complete, but thanks to COVID, no one can congregate. So Huang and Pastor Yang have been trying to think up ways they can utilize all that empty space for good. One idea is allowing homeless Pomonans to board in those upstairs lodgings. County regulations pose a challenge, but Huang and Yang see it as a duty.
In the United States, maybe more than 10,000 churches. If one church can help 20 or 25 homeless people, we can solve the homeless issue.
The church and the city have helped each other out since their mutual founding over 100 years ago. Hopefully, 100 years from now, they'll both be standing strong. For Annenberg Radio, I'm Ryan Coleman.
And that's all we have time for on today's From Where We Are. Unfortunately, we were unable to have Julia McGowan, the regular Thursday show host, with us today, but we're happy to have Stefan with us. Today's show was produced by Paulina Cherizova, Wilco Martinez-Cachero, and Jeffrey Lee.
Paulina Cherizova runs the soundboard, and Derek Renfro composed our theme music. We are streaming live on KXSC. Follow them at kxsc.org/listen.
And we're on YouTube at Annenberg Radio News. Subscribe to From Where We Are on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Annenberg Media. If you're looking for more news, download Annie, Annenberg's news app. I'm Jack Waterman.
And I'm Stefan Della Guardia. From all of us at Annenberg Radio, happy Veterans Day, and we hope you'll join us again for
From Where We Are.
Caddy, happy birthday!
See ya!